What is it like when undeserved mercy confronts undeniable evil, when kindness upends condemnation, and when heaven engages hell? Today, I interview two members of a family about how these things became real for them. It's a story we need to hear, to consider, and to share with our children and teens as a way to learn about God's amazing grace. Listen in as I chat with Tim Rogers and Megan Schertzer about how mercy is more powerful than murder on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, everybody, today on this episode of Youth Culture Matters, I'm going to have a conversation with a couple of folks who have lived through and are continuing to live through some really difficult circumstances that have been placed in their laps and in the life of their family, and how the Lord, we're going to talk about how the Lord has worked through that. This is a story that's been recounted in a brand new book by Megan Schertzer and Tim Rogers, A Father and a Daughter, and it's a story of how God has been working in the life of their family and even in the community here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where we live. And the book is called Beachdale Road, Where Mercy is More Powerful Than Murder, A True Story. And so I want to welcome Tim and Megan to Youth Culture Matters. Thanks for giving us some time today to have a conversation with you.
Now, thanks so much for having us, Walt. It's an honor to be here.
Tim.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, let me just say, Tim, just a little bit of background on these two. Tim, and contact was made between me and Tim. I mean, we've had contact before since we're in the same community here of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. But my son-in-law, Brandon Fisher, who is a lead pastor down in Paradise, Pennsylvania, connected me with Tim a few months ago regarding a manuscript that Tim and his daughter Megan had written. Tim is the lead pastor at Grace Point Church in Paradise, Pennsylvania. He's been there for more than 20 years. And his daughter Megan works as an adult advocate at the Factory Ministries, which is a fascinating place. I've had contact with them over the years, very involved in representing Christ in the community, doing great ministry. The Factory is in Paradise, Pennsylvania as well. And so this is a story that hits close to home. And I'm just going to start by saying, you know, hey, Tim, would you begin by telling us what it was that happened that prompted this whole story in the writing of this book?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Walt. Well, it was back in June of 2020 when our county, collectively Lancaster County, experienced, I would say, a collective grief and trauma together when Linda Stoltzer's 18-year-old Amish girl from Burdenham, Pennsylvania, went missing all of a sudden. And this doesn't just happen really ever. And so I remember, as maybe you do and others who might be in our community, the prayers, the concern, the loss we all felt as we waited for a while, what turned out to be 3 weeks before and there was any real answers. The FBI was called in. There was all kinds of search parties, all kinds of prayer meetings. That news of this traveled far and wide. And it was a few weeks in when we realized that it was my brother-in-law, Justo Smoker, who was identified as the man who kidnapped Linda. And that began our journey here of just, just unbelievable shock and grief. And I still feel it even as I recount it in this moment, Walt. I feel the tears coming to my eyes even right now, but it was deep for us. And in the years to come, you know, the processing of this, it ultimately has resulted in what you might be holding in your hand now in Beachdale Road, but that was the event, if you will, or the happening that kind of preempted this or prompted this writing, is not just that it happened, but what we experienced from the Amish community through this, which was deeply profound in medicine, places that were so personal and hard and difficult for us. That's a little bit of the background of what, what we're talking about.
So I clearly remember that was one of those days when if we turned on the news and even if it wasn't the news we were hearing through social media, people were texting each other and letting them know that this 18-year-old was actually walking home from church on a Sunday when she disappeared. And I distinctly remember that evening, I believe it was that evening in the days to come, her friends, and it may have been an Amish youth group, I remember the videos of them, the news reports of them meeting and seeing them singing, seeing them praying. As you mentioned, the search parties, I remember the lines of individuals from the larger community and first responders and the Amish community walking through cornfields, farmers fields, just wondering what in the world was going on. And this actually extended, I'm sure some who are listening, this wasn't just a news story here in Lancaster. This really hit the national news and was quite a big deal. So I know many, many people were following this. And as you mentioned, all of a sudden then, the unimaginable, it hit home. And you describe a lot of this in the book as how this came to be known. Would you be willing to give just a little bit of background on your brother-in-law and your family? You do talk about this in the book, so I'm guessing you're comfortable speaking about this, but just a little bit of the backstory.
Sure. Yeah. Justo was adopted into my wife's family many years prior when he was about, I think, 5 years old. He's been a loved member of the family from day one and continues to be today through incredible grief and tragedy. He had some of his own ups and downs. That is a matter of public record too, that he had been previously arrested and spent some time in jail as well. So he came from very, very difficult upbringing in Costa Rica and then came here and was a really, in a high school age, was a really promising athlete, outgoing personality, fun kid, seemed to show just a ton of promise. And I know, Megan, maybe you can speak if you want to some of your experience as his niece, because it was very much like any good uncle would treat his niece. He's been a beloved member of our family and again to this day, but had some real ups and downs. But I'll say this, and then Megan, if you want to say anything, you can. But he had recently come out of prison, finishing his previous sentence. Before this happened, it was many months prior to this happening. But so he had a bit of a rocky journey, but. And you had some different experiences.
Yeah, Megan, one of the things that really struck me was, just your, you were just very eagerly talking about what a great uncle, this was, and, mm-hmm. That he was. So, yeah, talk a little bit about your experience growing up.
Yeah, I remember him. I have childhood memories of him from before he went to prison the first time. And it was just as any fun uncle would be. We would run around and play games together. We would play princess together, dressing up in these fun costumes that my grandma had. I have specific memories of, this one specific game that I loved to play. I would run around the stairs. He would be there and like, ah, and I would run the other way. And then he would be there too. And we would laugh, and then while he was in prison, we wrote letters back and forth, and he wrote to some of my other siblings and cousins as well. And that was, I remember that being a really special experience, because I didn't have him around for most of my teenage years. And so to have him, to be able to still communicate via letters or on the phone as well when we would call him sometimes and talk to him in prison. And then when he got out of prison, we it was like things were just back to normal. And he was ready. He was, you know, he was excited to get to know us. He was coming to my soccer games. I had some indoor soccer games late at night, like 9, 10 p.m. He was there. Sometimes my parents weren't even there and he was there. And so I do remember just a fun, special connection with, I mean, with him, and he had that with all of us kids, I think.
Talk a little bit, you know, taking this story a bit further, and Tim, you started in on this. I think it was like 3 weeks later that the vehicles from the FBI pulled into the driveway, and my understanding is your wife and that family, and still very close, a Christian family, very close, and you describe where you live as being like they lived as kind of a compound, right? Everybody was there, and I actually think that that place, my son-in-law Brandon told me, does that abut where kind of backs up to where Brandon grew up down there,
that's right,
in the area. So you guys were neighbors, or the families were neighbors. So talk a little bit about that day that the FBI showed up.
Yeah. Well, they showed up on Thursday, I believe. And so when the SUVs rolled into the lane, a number of years prior, my father-in-law and mother-in-law had subdivided a portion of their land for Jen and I, my wife and I, to build our home. So we remain about, you know, 300, 500 feet down the lane from them, something like that. So all traffic we see and they see. So we share that space together. And then my sister-in-law, their other daughter, built up the lane, you know, 1,000 feet or so up the lane. So we all kind of are in this space. So when we saw the SUVs come in, it was not normal. We weren't sure what happened. After they left, Jen's parents talked to us and let us know what had happened, that the FBI had shown up to our place. And of course, the FBI was in our conscience already as a county, because we knew that they showed up to help with the search for Linda. So immediately there was real confusion, just confusion. Like, why would they come here? Because just maybe a couple of days prior, the Amish, some from the search parties, had come to search our woods without really any sense of connection to Justo and our family. Just they were searching the area for Linda, as they were searching many areas. So when the FBI started talking to my in-laws about Justo, it was, we just thought, well, they're just doing due diligence. I thought, well, he's a convicted criminal and he's out now. So they're just maybe doing their due diligence. And we had no expectation that it was anything more. Thought maybe there was parole violation, but that didn't quite make sense. The FBI doesn't get involved in that level. So it was still, even on that day, Thursday, even though they started asking about Justo's whereabouts and what have you, we still couldn't fathom this, because Justo has never been violent that way. He's just never been violent. He's stolen things before, but, you know, not violent. So it was still, on that Thursday, it was hard to imagine. And so it was the next day when the arrest happened, and he was arrested Friday. We didn't know what for. We just knew he was arrested. So again, even on that arrest on that Friday, we tried to withhold judgment because it still seemed so unfathomable. It just wasn't, it just, I don't know, there's got to be a stronger word than that, but it just didn't make any sense at all that Justo would be involved in this at all. And so we thought, well, maybe they questioned him about it and he got angry at work, and maybe, you know, whatever, they just held him for a little bit. But then it was finally on Saturday when the news broke to everybody what this was really about. And that was, you know, that was just beyond shocking. It was, yeah, no words for that.
If I have the timing right, when you say when he was arrested, that was about 3 weeks after Linda disappeared. So the county had been, and you know, folks who were tracking with this had been mounting in terms of, you know, where is she, what happened, that sort of thing. And so at this point now, this is where you know, we start to see the beauty of how the Amish community reacts to things. And by the way, that the arrest was made, just to clarify, he was arrested. There was no, she had not been found at this point. So it was on, you know, they had come to this decision on other matters. So it's at this point that the Amish community begins to respond, and that's where the story gets really interesting. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to have the two of you dive into that, because that really is the beauty that comes out of this, is as we see God's hand at work through the Amish community and how they interacted with you folks. So we're going to take a break. We're going to be right back. We're talking about the book Beachdale Road, Where Mercy is More Powerful Than Murder, A True Story. It's just out. It's been written by our friends here, Megan Schertzer and her dad, Tim Rogers. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
If you enjoy listening to Youth Culture Matters and would like to support the ongoing efforts of this ministry, you can do so by visiting cpyu.org/giving to make a donation. Your prayers and financial support make this podcast possible.
Well, welcome back, everybody. Again, we're chatting with Tim Rogers and his daughter, Megan Schertzer, who their family, not just the two of these folks, but their family has gone through and continues to go through a situation that is really unimaginable for so many of us. And they've written about it in their book, Beachdale Road. Tim, you said something to me during the break about the book, which just came out. I know it's available on Amazon and elsewhere. About the proceeds from the book. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. Thanks, Walt. Yeah, a portion of the proceeds are going to support Amish special education in Lancaster County. Linda helped out in an Amish one-room schoolhouse, and the children with special needs were really close to her heart. And so when we were talking with the family and representation around them about something that could honor Linda, this cause was something that we were made aware of. And so we're delighted to be able to give a portion of the proceeds back to Amish special education in Lancaster County.
Yeah. For those who don't live in Lancaster County, or who maybe, you know, have never visited and don't understand how Amish education works, either one of you, can you just summarize a little bit about how the educational system works for our Amish neighbors?
Yeah. So typically, if you're Amish and you're going to school, you start just like any other English kid in probably around 5 years old, but you only go to school until eighth grade. And so at the end of eighth grade, you're done with school and you go home and help work around the house. If you're a woman, you probably help cook and help your mom with chores around the home. And if you're a boy, you probably are helping your dad out in the field or otherwise to just kind of help around the home.
Yeah. And if you drive through Lancaster County, I mean, even here where I live in Western Lancaster County in the Elizabethtown area, we have, everywhere you drive, you'll see one-room schoolhouses. And I will say this, I love driving by the schoolhouses when it's recess time, and especially when it's the beginning of recess time and they bolt out that door and are playing. I'm just going to throw this in, you know, I get very excited because I think, as you two might know, so my son-in-law, Brandon, my daughter, Bethany, about a year ago built a house right across from the Paradise Park there. And as we've been down there to visit them on weekends, it's exposed me to something wonderful, and that is Amish softball. It is amazing to go down there. I ask Bethany and Brandon all the time, like, are they playing this weekend? Yes, there's a tournament this weekend. And I love to watch because, you know, it is some of the most amazing high-level softball I've ever seen, both the women and the men. I could do a whole podcast on Amish softball as someone who had coached baseball. I stood there the first time, and I turned to Brandon, and I said, I would draft these kids. They are pretty amazing. So, so that's the schoolhouse.
They're very good at volleyball too.
Yes, I know that. Don't Don't engage in volleyball or softball with the Amish if you want to win. That's the rule, right? So, and it's and they're extremely competitive, which is which makes it extra fun to watch. So, yeah. So in thinking about this before we move on, I have a question for you, Tim. One of the things that came to mind when I got the manuscript for the book, and I think I emailed the two of you and told you this, was that we on a past podcast had interviewed Jonas Beiler, and some know Jonas because he's typically known as the first man of the pretzel world, right? Because Annie Beiler's his wife, Annie Ann's Pretzels, and Jonas was a counselor. They've since moved to Texas, but they were down in your neck of the woods, and we've had a lot of interaction with Jonas and Ann, and Jonas was involved with first responders in terms of what happened at Nickel Mines, and many will remember that school shooting. Which was horrific years ago. And then also Joel Keim, who is a longtime friend of mine, who his story, he came on the podcast, told his story. We'll include a link to this particular podcast as well. But his story is that on a Sunday morning, he was spading and ran into an Amish buggy and killed the wife in a newlywed Amish couple. And the reason I bring that up is, as we transition here to talk about the response of the Amish community to you folks and to your family, the reason we talked about that was the podcast was all about forgiveness and just the amazing level of grace and forgiveness that the Amish choose to exercise. And so, Tim, in the book, you talk about how after the arrest, there was a knock at the door.
Yeah, there was a knock at the door, and I'm going to tell that story in just a second, but that your connection with Joel Keim, and, you know, I share that connection with Joel. In fact, Joel's brother Jeff was my roommate in college, and Joel and I went to youth group together at Grace Baptist Church, and I remember that day well and the impact it had on their family and the connections with that, and there's certainly, you know, we've been in touch with Joel since that time as well, and many in our community would be aware of that too. And there's also a connection to Nickel Mines, which comes right back to your question here, Walt. Just hours after the news broke in Lancaster newspaper about why Justa was arrested, but then it was front page. It was a big, you know, big font, of course, that Justa was arrested for the kidnapping. That was all that was at that time, kidnapping of Linda. For us and for me, I remember just there are a few times in my life, Walt, where I lose control of my body. I can't remember a time when I would just, people say you just had to sit down. It was that and more for me. I just couldn't hold myself anymore. I mean, when you read that on the computer screen, after all that our county had been through, that it's your family member who's arrested for this. I think I even wrote about it in that book. I just think I just slapped the counter and let out a loud no. It was just instinctive response, you know, just the pushback coming out of my own body for this. And shortly, just a few hours after that, then, to your question, there was a knock on the front door, and I was in no mood to answer the door, to be honest with you. I thought it was probably more police officers or something like that, and I didn't know what they needed, so I ultimately went to the door. It didn't take long, but I got to the door, and as I approached the door, I could see through the side lights that there was some young Amish children there, and as I opened the door, I saw their mom, Mary, standing there, and she had flowers in her one hand and a bag, plastic bag, turned out to be of cucumbers in her left hand. And she also had tears in her eyes. And she, I knew, was our neighbor just down the lane from us, like literally a few hundred feet from our door. And she knew why she was there, and I knew why she was there. She started in with, she said, "You may not know this, but I was the teacher at Nickel Mines." And she said, I just want you to know that there is hope in this, and that God is still good. And I'm struggling even for words now, Walt. And again, emotions are strong even in retelling the story for me, because the moment was so powerful for us, because it was in those immediate hours after reading the headline. It is a rush of anger and shame and grief and confusion and rage all in your body in response to this. When she showed up, she was the first one who started to meet us in a deep place to change a narrative, or to introduce to us that a narrative could change, that in that place of deepest grief and rage, that's where mercy can meet you. And she said, do you like cucumbers? Because I have some for you. And I don't like cucumbers at all. But I lied and I told her, we love cucumbers. Because in that moment, I remember thinking, I actually love cucumbers. Because what you've just done in this is you've given us a powerful gift of presence and mercy. There's nothing that can take away all that we're dealing with, but there is a little something that can be done, and that is showing up and giving, so these cucumbers were, in a sense, an embodiment of her attempt to show to us the goodness of God, even in the middle of, but at the very beginning of the rage and anger and pain that we were feeling about all of this. So her, and that she knew more than we did the journey that we were about to begin. She had been through nickel mines. She understood, and we were only at the beginning. That she showed up with what she did was an early marker for us, if we were paying attention and could see it, that God doesn't leave us alone in the middle of our grief and anger, and that mercy continues to meet us as we continue to wrestle with it, in both the deep grief of our soul and the attempt for people to show us and embody. You know, in the scriptures we read that taste and see that the Lord is good. Mm-hmm. Well, these cucumbers were that. This was, yeah, you taste them. This is the taste of love and mercy in the middle of real, real tragedy. That's what happened.
Yeah. And you know, it strikes me, I had not thought of this before, Tim, till you were telling it just now. And thank you for telling it. I can see Chris and I both are being kind of knocked in the gut here as you tell this, as I look across at Chris. But it strikes me that she had her children with her. And, you know, we the thing that I'm thinking about here is what an amazing lesson of, you know, when you think about the Amish community and the stories of grace and mercy and forgiveness, yours being one of those, you know, where does this come from? Obviously, the source is in God himself and in Jesus Christ. You know, these are not things we can conjure up on our own, but we do need to teach them to our children. And it just struck me as you were saying that they're witnessing this, and this is how this gets passed, you know, from generation to generation. Here I think a lot about how the scriptures say it only takes a generation to lose a generation, and how the Amish have remained committed to family and to nurture in ways that are quite an example and a challenge to us. So, yeah, I'm struggling for words now a little bit as well. Megan, how about you? You know, you heard the news a little bit just about that, and then how the Amish folks reached into your life as well.
Yeah, I remember when the FBI had showed up, I was actually leaving for the night to go to my friend's house. I had walked out the garage door and, you know, my mind's turning, you know, why are they here? What's going on? And I poked my head back in the door quick and kind of yelled to my mom. I said, Mom, you don't think it's about Linda, right? And she's like, oh, no. Like, I think she said, oh, my, no. Like, absolutely not. And that just solidified, like, what I thought I already knew. Like, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. Like, this, of course, it's not about her. Stupid question. Move on. And then came home the next day. I think I had barely been home 10 minutes. I was in my room and I knew my dad was at the counter because I had seen him when I came in, and I heard his hand on the counter. I heard this slam, and I can't remember other times in my life when he's done that. He doesn't typically get angry like that or react like that. And I just started sobbing. I just knew from hearing the sound of his hand. And so I came out, and him and my mom were there, and it took one look at them to just solidify what I already knew from that sound. So yeah, obviously a very emotional, very horrible day. I think the first words out of my mouth were, do you think the cops are wrong? Like, still, I was still like, but it doesn't make sense. It's not him. It doesn't make sense. Obviously, it turns out they weren't. But I think my experience with the Amish community has been very interesting and very unique as well throughout this process. Linda was my age, and so that added a whole other level to this whole thing.
Right, 18 at the time.
Yeah, 18 at the time. And so that added a whole other level to this in so many ways. But I think one of the crazy things is that that meant that her friends were also my age, and I got to know them. They came to our home a few separate times, once with their parents, once alone, actually several times alone. They brought Linda's youth group to sing for us. They came and cooked a meal for our whole family. And then, perhaps the most surprising one was a phone call that I received when our family was on vacation. And I ignored it because I thought it was a work call. But I let it go to voicemail. And as soon as I listened to the voicemail, I heard her friends asking me if I wanted to come to their house to celebrate my birthday. And I didn't even know they knew when my birthday was. But I was stuck without words. I was like, what is going on? They want the four of them, Linda's four closest friends, want to have me over to their house to celebrate my birthday. I think if I was them, I would be sulking that I didn't get to celebrate Linda's birthday anymore. But they invited me into their home. They made me dinner. They got me gifts. And we talked for 3 hours that night, just me and the four of them. It was the craziest birthday party I've ever had. It was very emotional. We laughed, we cried. We talked about, you know, normal teenage girl things, but also the thing that we were all going through at the time, which was a lot, I think, for us to go through at that age. And so we, you know, we talked about it all. And it was, I would say, those 3 hours really changed me.
Yeah, it's quite compelling when you read the story, and I know you add a lot more to it in the book. It's worth checking just for that. I mean, because here's the thing, all right? So as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the way that we typically would respond to things like this. So if, you know, I let's say I'm a friend, I have a friend where there's a loss of life and this sort of thing, there's a violent crime, there's a lot of anger. And there's a lot of holding. This is typically the way we handle things, right? Humanly, in our brokenness, and culturally, I think we're encouraged to do this in many ways, that we hold on to it. We get angry. We get angrier and angrier. We hold vendettas. We start to actually hate people rather than to offer forgiveness. And on the other side, and I'm thinking of you, and Tim, you mentioned, you know, several words. One of those that you mentioned was shame. You know, we tend to burrow into things and feel that, I'm guessing you felt strongly, both of you, that you and the rest of your family, that you were not worthy of these expressions of grace. And I think even as you talked about them coming to sing, a sense of that, you know, with that. So this really is so countercultural and I'm going to say this in a very gospel-centered way. You know, I think about the Apostle Paul and what we read in Romans 12 about living a life that's countercultural, that we don't go along with the, you know, the narrative that the world gives us about, you know, how to live our lives or handle difficulty or things like that. But it's so countercultural, and that for me is it, just as with when I heard Jonas talk about nickel mines, or Joel tell his story. It's very challenging personally, and so we're going to take a break here, and when we come back in the last segment, I want to ask you about, you know, lessons learned in a very personal way, you know, how this God has used us to transform you, and then maybe some challenges you could give to folks who, like all of us, tend to lean into the cultural narrative rather than the gospel narrative on how to handle difficulty and suffering and brokenness and that sort of thing. That's what I think is some of the great, great good that's coming out of this as I listen to you, as I read the book. So we'll take a break. We're going to come back. We'll finish up our conversation with Megan and with Tim. Hey there, Youth Culture Matters listeners. We've been told that one of our best-kept secrets here at CPYU is our one-minute daily podcast, Youth Culture Today. Each and every weekday, we release a new episode that's timely, practical, and hope-filled, all for an audience of parents, youth workers, and anyone else who cares about kids. Here's a sample from one of our recent Youth Culture Today episodes.
Youth Culture Today with Walt Mueller of the Center for Parent Youth Understanding.
Why do so many parents tiptoe gingerly around their children in today's world? More and more parents are afraid to step in, take the reins, and assume their God-given position of authority. Instead, parents have become like butlers, available to wait on and serve their kids' every desire and whim. Fearing rejection, we sometimes go against our better judgment and God's design to say yes when we should be saying no. God established the family with a pecking order. Those who are older and wiser are charged with the duty of raising, nurturing, and protecting those who are young and not so wise. In other words, parents are to parent their children. Dad, Mom, you have a God-given responsibility to love your teenager, to guide them through life, to protect them from harm, and to provide for their well-being. This means that there are times when you will have to teach your kids God's will and way by saying no. Parent your teenagers to the glory of God.
For more on youth culture, visit us on the web at cpyu.org.
Youth workers, do your parents a favor and get them to subscribe to Youth Culture Today wherever they get their podcasts. Well, welcome back, everybody. I want to mention that when we talk about the book Beachdale Road, that's the title of the book that Tim and Megan have written about this story. Beachdale is not spelled the way you would think of it if you live on the coast or vacation at the beach. It's not B-E-A-C-H-D-A-L-E. It's beach, as in like a beech tree. B-E-E-C-H-D-A-L-E. Beachdale Road, that's the title of the book, subtitled Where Mercy is More Powerful Than Murder, A True Story. And Megan, you want to say something about the website? Because we will include in the show notes with a player for this on our website, cpyu.org, we will include links to where people can find the book, and then also to the website that has been put together around the book. You want to say something about that and where we can find that?
Yeah, the website is called beachdaleroad.com. And there's several things on there. There are events, local events that we may be speaking at, author bios, a little bit about us. There are links to local news articles. This podcast will also be linked to our website, as well as just like an overview of the book and a way to purchase the book.
Great, great. And we hope folks will go there to check that out. In this last segment, I really want to hear from the two of you just a bit about, I'll just let you talk, lessons learned, how this has transformed you personally, how has it changed your ministry, and Tim, how you preach, how you lead. It touches everything, I'm sure. And, you know, some challenges, some perspectives that you've had that you would want to pass on to folks who are listening that would be helpful to us as we think about what it means to live our lives, not to the glory of self, but to the glory of God. And either one of you can start.
Well, I guess I'll jump in real quick.
Dad first.
I think for me, if I could summarize it this way, if you can imagine what it would be like, and I remember sitting there at my kitchen table one day, and we wrote about this in the book. It was the first night that we were going to meet some liaisons from Linda's family were coming to meet with us because it was just a few weeks after this had gone down, and they wanted to come to meet with our family. And I still remember sitting in that moment. We were just a couple weeks into it at this time, and it was still so heavy. The weight of, we call it guilt by proxy, was so strong. And one of my pastor friends asked me, "What are you going to say to them tonight?" And I remember through tears saying, "If 1,000 apologies would help, we would offer that. But what is there? What do you say? 1,000 isn't even enough. I mean, what is there that you can possibly offer that can come anywhere close to trying to express the recognition of the loss that your family member has created in the lives of other people?" In some ways, you look at it and say it's irredeemable, in that you can't bring her back. Like, what are you supposed to say to that? And so we sat there.
Yeah, and by the way, just because we didn't get to this, bring her back. We did not mention that. How many months later were the police led to her body? So,
It was 6 months later.
6 months later.
Oh,
Six,
sorry,
no.
Megan.
It was about 9.
9 months.
It was March or April.
Right. So there was this lag, and then it went from being charged with kidnapping to being charged with murder. So you're actually in this right now. What you're talking about is before her body was found.
So before her body was found, and we're still sitting there saying we're not sure what to say to these people at all. And so when you face that, and when we also had the opportunity to sit with Linda's parents, and you share a living room with them, and you see the weight of this on her dad and her mom, that is, you just feel horrible, and helpless to do anything about it. And what they came to express to us was not a desire for us to give anything to them. They came simply to tell us that they love us and they hold nothing against us. And I don't know what else could have possibly been done except that produced such, not only the potential for healing, but also, if I'm honest, it was an uncomfortable weight of grace. For the first time in my life, and I've preached the gospel for multiple decades now, I felt the weight of what I believe, that it is by grace you have been saved through faith. This not of yourselves, it is the gift of God. Lest you should boast, lest you should think for a minute you have something to offer God. I got that in my head, right? Like, I can explain that intellectually. That's fine. It makes sense to me. But the weight of it set here, this was the gospel incarnated in this space, because it was maybe, not maybe, it was the very first time that I had nothing of any substance that I could offer back to the person giving me grace. Like, even if you think of a really nice birthday gift, if someone gives you an above and beyond birthday gift and they expect nothing out of it, what I can at least do is talk them up with my friend. I can say, "Look at, aren't they great people? Like, this is great. They did a wonderful thing. I can maybe return a gift to them that's of equal value. Perhaps I can thank them for it. I can do something that will kind of return the favor, even if it's a small act of work that way. What can I do in this case, right? Like, what exactly do you offer to people whose family member, your family member, took from them?" I mean, so for me, to experience the the ongoing decisions from Linda's youth group to her family, to her friends, to offer to us this grace, it forced me to sit and stare at the fact that grace and mercy in the face of shame is maybe the most powerful, also unwelcome and difficult gift to receive. I would have some days preferred the narrative of, yeah, just hate us. Just get angry with us. Like, I'll understand that. Like, in fact, I may even think that would be easier for me. Just scream at us. Like, just get it out, because that's what I feel like doing. But what they did is offered this level of kindness and mercy. And so for me, it has deeply changed how I not only experience my faith, but how I preach, yes, how I lead, how I try to serve, in seeing the what can meet shame and pain at a point of its greatest need is this undeserved mercy, undeserved grace that is really, for us, has been really life changing. So that's been a big lesson for us, for me.
Yeah. So I hear you. Thank you for sharing that. I hear you saying, you know, what comes into mind for me is, okay, theologically, philosophically, I can talk about this, I can understand it at some level, but until you've experienced it and been on the receiving end from people who functionally are living this at great cost too, right? The word I'm thinking of is amazing, you know, not to be trite, but grace is amazing. Megan, what about you?
Yeah, I would say that the biggest thing for me has been a completely new understanding of what God's grace even is and what it means for me. I think back to specifically when Mary's sister's youth group came to sing for us, for our family. And it was the first time an Amish youth group had come to sing for us. There would turn out to be a few more times, but I was so uncomfortable. I did not want them to be there. I wanted to go home, and I felt the weight of what my dad was just saying, and that, like, what are we supposed to say to them? Like, sorry, you know, what are we supposed to do? Are we like, we'll put out some snacks for you? Or like, it just, everything felt so like it, nothing felt like enough. And I think that our natural reaction as humans is to try to work our way back into good graces, and there's just nothing to do. And so when we can't do that, it felt really hard. And I just felt like we didn't deserve their presence. We didn't deserve their kindness. And as I continued to think that night, I thought, you know, I did not do anything wrong. This is not my fault. Why do I feel like I don't deserve this? It's not like I did anything wrong. And then I kind of paralleled that to our relationship with the Lord. Like, okay, I do sin against the Lord, and I do things wrong per se. And so how much more do I not deserve his grace than this right here in front of me? And so I kind of caught myself in this attitude of like feeling like I could work in some capacity for my faith, even though I wouldn't have said that. I think I was working in other areas, you know, maybe athletically, working hard in the off season so you get the starting spot, or working hard in school to get the good grades. And I kind of felt like, I'm a Christian, I believe in the Lord, I've given myself to him, so like, of course he would want me in heaven someday. And yep, in a sense, like, I deserve heaven, I deserve to be with him. And kind of caught myself in like, no, you don't. You don't deserve anything. We deserve nothing. And it was like this humbling moment for me of like, man, we do not deserve anything. As humans, we deserve death. We deserve to be separated from God, no matter how good we think we are. And there is nothing to offer God that he doesn't already have. When he offers us his grace, I don't need to try to earn that grace. It's just free, and the beauty of it is that it's free, but it's also really, really hard. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's
absolutely
kind of what I feel like I really truly learned in that space.
Wow, this is we're so grateful that you've taken the time out of your day to have this conversation with us. I know our time is short here. We promised we'd let you go at a certain point, but I just want to say thank you for being open with this. I'm sure there's so much still, you know, even as I listen to the two of you talk, I know this is still in process, and this is going to be a lifelong journey, I'm sure. And thank you for letting people into it, not only through the podcast here, but through the book. And so I want to recommend, you know, I've read it twice. And I am, as people who know me know that it takes a lot for me to recommend a book, right? Because anybody can write a book, and there's tons of books out there now. This one is worth reading, and it's one I highly recommend. Adults, I'm just going to share with you, you know, to learn about grace, to learn about mercy, to hear how the Lord worked through this story and is continuing to work. Book clubs, if you have a book club, you know, read it on your own. And I want to recommend to our youth worker friends, this is a book that you could bring into your youth group and read with your students in a small group. It's not weighty in terms of the length of it. It is weighty in terms of the content, in the sense that it really does hit us hard, as you've heard here today. But it's a weight that we need to carry and learn from. And so family's the same thing. And I do want to say this. When I went on Amazon, I noticed that it's recommended ages 8 and up. And you might be surprised by that, but when you read it, you realize this is, well, just think of Mary, right? Bringing the kids to the front door with the cucumbers. This is a great lesson to teach to our kids. The younger they are, the better, to learn about God's grace and how to show grace and forgiveness. So, again, Megan, you want to mention the website one more time?
Yes, website is beachdaleroad.com, and that's BEECHDALE.
Great. Thank you so much. Tim, blessings in your ministry. I want to stay in touch with you and catch up a little bit more. I know it's been a while. And then Megan as well, thanks for your good work with your team there at the factory. And we're grateful for what you folks are doing and also grateful for what the Lord is doing in your life through all this. So pray for this family, folks. Pray for Megan. Pray for Tim. Pray for Justo. Pray for Linda's family, the Amish community, everyone involved in this. This is not something that happens and then goes away. And so pray for them, if you would. Thanks, everybody, for listening in. And we will catch you on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.